Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This episode was originally recorded December 2020.
Okay, welcome everybody. I'm so happy and honored to have the author and brave adventurer and feminist activist Kiri Westby on the line with me, and to talk about her wonderful new book, "Fortune Favors the Brave," which I like a lot. It's about some of her adventures in the past, and so I'm very delighted to have her. And she published this wonderful book last year, and she had a 30-city tour waiting to go, and then bam, the nature, the animals from the ravaged rainforest struck back at humanity, and we've been locked down ever since. And she's now home in Boulder, I believe, and I'm here in the Catskill Mountains, and I haven't left here except for one day. I went to New York City for one night in the last year. And I don't know, I think you had more adventures than me, Kay. So anyway, welcome, and how are you doing? How is the family? How's everyone?
Thanks, Bob. I'm so excited to be here with you in this moment. And we're doing well. It's day after Christmas, Boxing Day, and my kids are sort of mercifully sleeping in a bit after a big day yesterday.
Yes, a big Christmas day. And it's a wonderful thing for the children, you know. We are at the grandchildren level, and they're at different ages. And so some are here, some are not here. It's been very confusing trying to schedule the Santa moments, you know. It's been very complicated. So now, Kiri, please tell us a little bit, how did you get on this amazing trip that you chronicle? I mean, you could start, if you like, in your previous lives. You remember them.
I know.
Whatever you like, or you can start in your youth, or you can start anywhere you like. Please tell us how you got onto this amazing trip that you chronicle in your exciting book.
Well, it does seem that way a little bit faded from lifetimes. But I was born into the sort of experimental and new branch of Tibetan Buddhism called Shambhala in Boulder. Mm-hmm. And I was raised in private Buddhist schools through my childhood, and took different vows and Dharmic art practices through my education. So I think early on, I always had kind of an awareness of certain tenets of Buddhism, like karma and merit and reincarnation and a lot of those sort of basic tenets and thoughts. And I also was aware of the occupation of Tibet because the teacher was a Tibetan exile, refugee. And I was sort of aware of the concept of occupation or war, armed conflict from an early age. So those things kind of combined in my early 20s when I was found a job with this very exciting and brand new frontline feminist funding network called Urgent Action Fund. And at 22, I was their first full-time employee. And we were seeking to kind of revolutionize the old model of philanthropic funding, especially in war zones, and to cut out some of the middlemen and to create really direct networks of connections with feminist activists on the ground, and to get money and resources into their hands with the least amount of red tape as possible, which was revolutionary in the funding world. So the first 5 years of my activism. I think it still is. First 5 years of my activism were spent traveling in and out of war zones, building these networks of trust and communication so we could move money and resources quickly. The International Criminal Court was being developed and we're starting to try cases around war crimes. And we were providing direct evidence, documented evidence. We were providing money on the ground. Now, what's interesting about that is I was a 22-year-old blonde American girl. And I was sort of the least likely person to come walking up by foot to walk across the border into, say, the Democratic Republic of Congo or up into Aceh or in certain places. And so almost my my anomaly caused me to have a certain amount of privilege and movement and my passport. And I was learning how to use those unearned privileges as a, a tool to leverage within movements because I could cross borders others couldn't, and because I was often not searched in the same way others were. And so I became sort of a tool for this new fund to move money, information, resources across borders clandestinely. So I had been doing that for many years. And and just as a side note, I just want to share with you, you may not know that this past week, Mackenzie Scott, the ex-wife of Jeff Bezos of Amazon, donated, you know, $4 billion globally.
Yes, I did hear that, yes.
And Urgent Action Fund received $20 million of that. So,
oh, that's wonderful.
This fledgling vision idea that we had that we could do this. And all the nights of writing grant proposals and begging for every dollar and every donation, us sort of founding mothers have been celebrating all week that like it's going to have an impact for generations long beyond us.
That's wonderful. Are you going to continue to work with them yourself?
Yeah, I think in some capacity, I always consider part of the your Urgent Action Fund family. And on March 8th of this year, they threw the book launch for Fortune Favors the Brave, which then on March 9th, the country shut down. But it was on International Women's Day, and we had our last final celebration. And, and the book is a fundraiser for both Urgent Action Fund and for Students for a Free Tibet. I'll show you the fun cover.
Right. And the cover, by the way. I love it.
Thank you. And so, yeah, so I think... it's just been a really good week, a good end to a painful and difficult year to know that this work we sort of pulled together and risked so much to create will continue in perpetuity.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So,
well, you know, I remember reading your book, and particularly you had some very scary encounter. What was the most frightening encounter that you had, actually, maybe? Can you tell us?
I think there's a moment I detail of a mission I was in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in which I got off the plane for a stop, a pit stop. And we were maybe not aware that that particular stop was held by a rebel faction. And I took a photograph. Seems simple, but it can be quite a dangerous thing to do in a war zone. And within minutes, myself and my colleague had machine guns pointed at our faces, and we were walked off the plane and brought into a small shack. And we didn't know if the plane had left with all of our belongings, and we were highly interrogated. And I think that was one of the moments where I thought, I may just die here and nobody would know for a very long time.
How did you escape?
I escaped because I happened to have a $20 bill in my pocket randomly. After a lot of negotiations, I reached into my pocket and I felt this corner of a bill that I'd had too much for the cab driver to the way to the airport. And I offered it up, and suddenly the whole tone changed and we were allowed to go back onto the plane. And I thought, wow, $20, what that wouldn't get me back home in Boulder.
Oh my goodness,
The price of our freedom in the Congo, so.
Yeah, I remember you telling me about Congo, how terrifying it is to even think of the backwoods there in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And I remember you telling me about how you ran into a lot of these poor young girls who were badly mutilated and had been badly treated. I mean, horrendously, practically. Death's door and a violation of that, any kind of violation you can imagine. And they were brandishing and asking you about Angelina. And you told me that she had made a huge impact there. And I was very surprised. Very courageous of her, I think. And so did you find traces of her and more? You were in a number of places there, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, at the same time she was doing as a goodwill ambassador in conflict zones, I was doing a lot of this work. And I'm not someone who has television or has watched a lot of movies in my life, but in the activist world, I know her name as someone who is incredibly legitimate and really has put herself in places very few people would dare to go, especially people of her stature.
I was deeply impressed by that myself. I really admire that in her. You know, I don't know what she's been doing since, but I do admire that, and in you. So, this is amazing, amazing that you had this bravery to do this. So, when you say you understand, to go back to what you said before, you were brought up in the Shambhala community, and as a child, and you learned about reincarnation and about karma and so on. How do you think that enabled you or spurred you or to join such a dangerous activities? Actually, what was it that gave you the courage? How can you say that?
Well, so the main premise that sort of in the way I write my book and tell my story is through this, the bravest action of my life, which was at Mount Everest in 2007. Where I joined a Tibetan freedom protest and were sort of very publicly arrested and disappeared by the Chinese government, right, as they were leading up to the 2008 Beijing Olympics.
And you were more scared by that than about, you were more frightened by that than by the Congo? The Chinese were more scary than, that's really interesting.
It got scarier as the days went on, for sure. I think it was one of those where I went in purposefully with a lot of American kind of bravado. And I used a lot of the tricks I'd learned in all my years in war zones to help a Tibetan Tenzin Dorje to sort of sneak into Lhasa and across the Tibetan plateau and up to Everest, which is an incredibly difficult thing to do. And you go through so many checkpoints and you have so many permits to apply for. And at each one, I had to pull out just the ugliest side of that American entitled, you can't, we're refusing to take no for an answer attitude. And so when we got to the day of the protest and it actually miraculously worked, and we were the first, I think, to send a satellite signal from base camp with images to a computer in New York. I think I went into the arrests maybe with a lot of that kind of bravado and arrogance in it to begin with. And to begin with, we were arrested by the local military who live there and who, there's a small jail there at Everest Base Camp, but it wasn't, there wasn't too much aggression. They had guns, but they also were giving us cigarettes and water. And it was kind of like, they were shocked that we had even done it. And at that point, nobody knew that it was more than just a local action. Nobody there knew we had had a satellite and we'd sent this whole video out. And so it was a lot of just confusion in the first 14 hours that we were held in that cell there at base camp. And I did some media interviews from the toilet. They never searched us. They didn't take my phone. And then about 14 hours later, the secret police, the showed up and everything changed. And so then they searched us, separated us, and started systematically threatening us and intimidating us and abusing all the Tibetans around us that had had any contact with us. And just by the second or third day of being in interrogation, I did think that that would be the end of my life as I knew it, that I was going to spend the rest of my life in a prison camp, or at least for a long time in my life. And I had grown up with stories of Paul Dingyatso, and I had grown up with stories of the Dropchi nuns, and I knew about some of the stories that had snuck out from Chinese prison camps. And I had sort of had this picture of where I was heading in my mind. And but once again, our strategy, our security strategy was what it would happen if they did this to Americans, from mm-hmm. average Americans from Colorado and San Francisco? Mm-hmm. Would they treat mm-hmm. us the same way? What would happen mm-hmm. if you could apply that political pressure? Mm-hmm. And it worked. And so mm-hmm. within 3 days, our congressmen were speaking, our president got involved, Secretary of State got involved, and we mm-hmm. were actually released instead of being charged. So but I think that, yeah, I think it all comes together. It's like my upbringing in the Buddhism and having those sort of thoughts about merit and what this lifetime is all mm-hmm. about, and the mm-hmm. Combining with years of clandestine work in war zones. And I was sort mm-hmm. of the right person for this one role at this one moment. And mm-hmm. Students for a Free Tibet was looking for people like me and other sort of American activists willing to use mm-hmm. their passports. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. to leverage this story. Mm-hmm. And it worked. Mm-hmm. And it was like us mm-hmm. five nonviolent Americans went there, and we caused a huge thorn in the side of the world's largest authoritarian mm-hmm. government.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was very, very, very good. It was very good. Some people, of course, feel that there's always the feeling, I have heard people say that it was unnecessarily provocative and it brought worse crackdown on Tibetans and this sort of thing. There is that feeling in some quarters.
Definitely.
Have you encountered that?
Even in the Shambhala world a bit, about sort of how it prevented certain teachers from traveling and how it caused mm-hmm. further suffering. And mm-hmm. it's kind of that old sort of argument against stirring the pot, you know, like mm-hmm. just stay where you are. And if you stir the pot, it'll get worse.
Right, right.
I think my training is more to be a pot stirrer and a bit of a truth teller, and to say, you know, the real, you know, perpetrator is the Chinese government. It's not us five unarmed Americans. And things did get worse in Tibet through 2008, and a huge uprising occurred. But there's also messages from within Tibet that people felt very supported by our actions, that people they'd never met would care enough to put their lives on the line in another country. Yeah.
Yes, yes. So I think it is on balance, truth is really great. And even if it seems to make things worse, it's because the underlying worse is lying there and is being inflicted on people steadily in a sort of structural injustice and structural oppression and so on. And so this sort of brings it out. It's sort of like what maybe sometimes I think the horrendous Trump years will ultimately signify. It was a time, in a way, you could say he's brought the sort of white supremacy and all these kinds of insane regressive American strands that have been there since the Native American genocide and through the slavery and through the Civil War and all of that. And he's brought it out, he's added to it, or he's been the conclusion of it, you can say, in one sense. And in another sense, he blew the cover of people who were dog whistling for decades, if not centuries.
Definitely.
And I think he's always holding us back from realizing, maybe you could say, the ideal, not just an American ideal, but a Christian ideal, a Buddhist ideal, you know, an Islamic spiritual ideal, you know, even the mm-hmm. secular humanists maybe have, you could say. So truth has to be there, even if it seems to have immediate painful consequences by the baddies.
Yeah, and I think this was the year mm-hmm. that so many people found what their line was, you know, whether it was the murder of George Floyd or the mishandling of the pandemic, or the just blatant corruption in government, where mm-hmm. what we're seeing is we're seeing people who are within those privileged circles of power speaking out. We're seeing whistleblowers and people speaking their truth to power in a way that creates real change and is not about the savior complex of others, but is about using the leveraging the access mm-hmm. we have to make change. Mm-hmm. And
absolutely.
I feel like in the Buddhist world, like, you know, my parents were part of that kind of travelers who went to India in 1970 from across the Great Hippie Trail, and mm-hmm. kind of part of the big kind of inhalation, if you will, of Buddhist Dharma. Mm-hmm. And my generation, I feel, is part of the exhalation or the outbreath of what that created, because it created hundreds of us who were also raised in a certain way, who see our lives as useful and are meaningful as we act on behalf of others. And so I think that I'm seeing that in lots of places. Yeah.
That's wonderful. You, I don't know if you know Michelle Alexander, if you know who that is, wrote, she's a sociologist at, I think, University of Chicago or somewhere, some nearby university. And sorry, I'm not specific on that. And she wrote a wonderful book called The New Jim Crow.
And I've heard the book, yeah.
She wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that I loved sometime during this last horrendous year, in which she said she almost wished that she believed in reincarnation, or that people in general did, because maybe then there would be less cruelty and less horrendous behavior on their part if they actually did. And I was so struck by that. I don't know her. I had once a chance to meet her and unfortunately missed the chance. And she's friends of mine at the Union Seminary in New York. And I was invited to a dialogue thing with her, but I couldn't make it. But a year before that. But I was struck by that. And I wonder if you feel that. Do you feel when you were facing death? And the other one that I remember is where you had to sneak out through a bathroom where you were being imprisoned to be molested in a rather bad way. And that was in Congo, I think. Right?
That was in Sri Lanka, actually. That was in Southern
Sri Lanka. In Sri Lanka. Oh, dear.
In Sri Lanka.
Okay, in Sri Lanka. A terrible, formerly a Buddhist country.
Exactly.
And in some respects still, but not totally, obviously. And did that actually make you feel that death would be just another adventure? Or was there any way it changed your attitude about the danger of that fear of death? Did it affect you in any way?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's this saying these days among young people, YOLO. Have you heard that? It's YOLO.
Yeah, well,
and it stands for you only live once. And it's a sort a sense of, like, you know, no responsibility, no accountability, YOLO. And I see it a lot with younger kids and younger people I interact with. And it's
opposite
to my Buddhist training, which is like, no, really, you don't only live once. And that there's so much that happens in this lifetime, in my belief, that has profound effects on lifetimes after you're here. And that I think if there's an underlying message to this pandemic, it's that same, like, if you act individually, you are at risk. If you can act communally or think beyond yourself, you may survive this. And so I think, and it may be also the kind of concept of the Bodhisattva and the Bodhisattva vows, which are about coming back again lifetimes to help humanity and to work with liberating humanity. And those kind of combine into my activism in war zones. I did several times think that this may be the way that I was going to die. And also at the time felt okay with that, because I was doing something that I felt so committed to, and I was sort of in my truth and in my justice. And so we all die at some point. And I think dying in that way.
So your slogan would be YOLO at. YOLO at. So you only live once at a time.
Exactly. Or you only live 1,000 times.
Once at a time.
You know? Once at a time.
So if any one time you can be infinite, you can be, I love what you said, beyond yourself, or infinite, or expand beyond just the boundary, arbitrary boundary of the skin. Only once at a time. That's really, really interesting. Really,
I
never knew YOLO. I deal with YOLO all the time myself, but they never use the word YOLO or the expression YOLO. In other words, it's interesting because for years I have given talks in many places, and I've tackled the death means that you become nothing attitude, which leads to a psychotic recklessness of our culture.
Yes.
I personally believe it's really critical. It's a key thing that you can get out of the consequence of how you live and how you behave just by dying. So that in a way, their death, they supposedly, although they fool themselves into thinking that they're being brave to be nothing, actually, since nothing is subliminally understood by them as anesthesia, at least no pain. Then exactly. It's actually an escape. It's a total escape. You know?
It's a total escape.
And this so I've been year dealing with that for a long time, but they never said YOLO. These older people. And you see, my imprisonment is being imprisoned with the elderly or the older people.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think the young kids, the young YOLO kids would have ever come to one of my lectures. So therefore, they didn't jump up and say, YOLO, I'm into YOLO. Because otherwise, I would have given them YOLO at, you know.
Exactly.
You know,
at a time.
You only live once at a time, you know.
And, I think that it is so interesting that my book as a memoir, and it's very just raw, my story of coming up against my white privilege, my Western supremacy, my heteronormativity, even my feminist fundamentalisms. I wrote it for my sort of younger self. I wrote it for the idealist that wants to go out and save the world so that I could spare them some of the painful lessons that I learned and, you know, and take some of the burden off the women who shared those lessons with me patiently and share them in circles where people can hear them. So I just spoke to my very first university class that was assigned the book at San Diego State University and had a fascinating discussion with young kids, 19, 20 years old, about their role in the world, about this question about sort of if you're not from a culture, could you go over and work and do make change in that culture? There was, you know, sort of that criticism of us being Americans and going into China, to Tibet, which is in our culture, and speaking out. We talked about that, and we talked a lot about just the importance of story and of sharing one's story. And so I think what is unique about my book is that it's a memoir and it reads like a novel, like first person, present tense, and young people are getting into it. Like instead of it being didactic, it's really encompassing. They can dive
wonderful.
Into it.
Wonderful. Well, I hope do you have a tour planned for after the COVID is over and you can do one then? I mean,
I would like to.
A paperback or something.
Yeah, I would really like to. I've gotten some really great feedback from people like Ellen Burstyn and great quotes that weren't included in this version of the book. And
so good.
The plan was for me and my husband and our two kids to get in our old VW van and drive the country and talk to people and hit up independent bookstores. So I would love to do that when it's safe to do so again.
I think it's very, very important. And of course, I'm sure you're writing another book. What are you writing now? What are you doing now?
I am. Well, in the 10 years that I was working on this book, I had two children. So I've been working on a book. It's called Mothering on the Edge. And sort of circumnavigating the hope and fear around all of it, postpartum and pandemic playdates and puberty. So my next book will be specifically how I apply some of my war zone training to the frontline job of motherhood, which I think may be the hardest job in the world. So
Right.
Yeah.
So that's really exciting. So but you don't think of doing active missions again yourself because of the mother responsibility. Maybe you can't so well. Or
I mean, now I have a 10-year-old and a 5-year-old, so I'm still in it.
Yes.
And with this pandemic, I'm really in it, learning fifth grade math and bouncing off the wall.
Oh, yes.
Schooler. But I don't think I'll ever stop being an activist, even if it's in different ways. And that's something that I talk about in my book, which is that sometimes you are at the front line and sometimes you are invisibly part of the support staff. And I have spent a lot of my activism years on the front line and with my face out there. And now a lot of my activism is in support. So sitting on boards, donating, supporting activists in a way of self-care that is very rarely funded. And I've been doing that all summer, sort of supporting in the backgrounds as the racial uprising has been happening. And so I think I'm still very much involved, but in a way that I can be effectively involved right now. I'm not the most effective person for the front lines. So
No, I agree. And just like, for example, you were out there and there were some elder women who were supporting you and targeting you and who were having you work within their network where a younger person could do something in the sense of be perceived as more more innocent and more blithe, more less, as you said, you were not searched the same way, et cetera, a lot of things like that.
Yeah.
And so there is that other way of interacting. And now I think of the UAF, you know, you call it UAF, the Ubuntu Air Force.
I know.
Ubuntu Activism Network. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful organization. I hope they're still flourishing, and obviously they are.
Oh, yeah. Well, now they have four sister funds, one in the U.S., one in Africa, one in Latin America and the Caribbean, and one in Asia and Pacific Islands. So they they have 25, maybe 30 full-time employees, all young people.
Oh,
now they
good,
have this
oh,
incredible gift from Mackenzie Scott, and I think they're going to take over the world. I feel like I have full faith in them.
That's good.
Fully behind them.
Well, that's good. Well, yeah. We could also call it the oxytocin network as opposed to the cortisol network that is currently in charge and is destroying the world. You
we
know,
could
the
all
male,
use more oxytocin.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
We all need more of that.
Well, that is the oxytocin network. You know, I'm totally. Yeah. Actually, when I say I'm intellectually totally a feminist. But my good wife, as you know her, Nina, I think you met her. Yes, you have met her.
Yeah.
And she is always telling me that I still have habits, you know. So I'm still a disciple, you know, rather than an activist. But intellectually, certainly, I am 100% feminist. And actually, I shock Buddhist audiences by teaching that the female embodiment of the humans is the more advanced one rather than the male, even though in the history of Buddhism, there have been many more known male, you know, saints and meditators and so forth who are known, but they all have been instructed by females, actually, really, especially if you look in the tantras. But you don't know the names of the females. The females are not named. They didn't write the books, et cetera, usually.
Right.
Very few. And that should change now, actually. That should change. So I think we need a lot of yoginis, and I've been trying to teach them. I have a thing called Vajra Yoga. I'm trying to teach them. But anyway, you should definitely. So you said some painful things that you had, mistakes that you made. Can you think of any that you could save
off
a young
the top
person,
of my head?
Younger person from?
I think that it was sort of the slow waking up to a lot of the Western privileges and sort of viewpoints that I had when I got into real global international activism. Seeing the role my country and my government was actually playing outside of my government. That's quite eye-opening for me as a young person and really led me to come back to my own country to sort of make that shift back into the unearned circles, unearned privileged circles that I could have my voice be effective. And it was an activist, a South African activist, actually, that said to me, you know, what are you doing here in Africa when it's your government who you need to be lobbying, who are actively underdeveloping the world? And that hit very, very strongly with me as I kind of came back into my country. Now I do a lot of political work and activism.
Well, good. Yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Yes. So, although I do feel, for example, what is America anyway? You know,
right.
In other words, there's one America that isn't America, but unfortunately rules it sometimes and directs it in the wrong direction. That is a sort of last vestige of the British Empire.
Right,
you know,
that
the
manifest
Arnold,
destiny
like,
kind
we,
of,
we
yeah.
Had, we finally had a Benedict Arnold for a president.
Yeah.
Actual Benedict Arnold, who was in league with the KGB, with the Nazis, with the civil, with the secessionists. You know, that with the slaveholders and with the Native American genociders, which I don't believe those people have ever arrived in America. They all lament that we weren't just there openly expanding the British Empire. To me, that's been what that is. Whereas what really America is a nation of immigrants and a nation of people who are aware that somehow we represent and we should try to represent a possibility of all the different nations, you know, like in Jefferson's second inaugural, the idea is that we create an example that leads other nations to try to not be super casteist, classist, racist, genocidal about their lower classes, et cetera, enslaving their lower classes. And that's really the mission on Turtle Island. Let's call it Turtle Island. I don't know if we want to use a different name. But which is because the American name is actually a colonist name, or the Portuguese guy, you know, although the Portuguese landed down in Brazil. But the thing is, so that to me is what America really is. And so to me, that means that you can resist those who say, you know, but of course, and it is our fault that those of us who have that attitude about what America is have not somehow remained in control of the machinery of the government, which has more been used in a neo-colonialist way, you know.
Yeah.
And you just put it down. I'll come at neo-colonialist way. So I think there's two kinds of, we should insist that there are two kinds of America. And we are the real one, actually, the one.
Well, and it takes our active participation. And that is what people are waking up to. Young people, is they're saying, if we don't vote, if we don't put the people, even in the smallest places of leadership, that can think for all, then this is what it looks like. Because they, people, you know, it's a constant thing to strive for and to be part of. And I am, you know, my ancestors came over on the Mayflower in 1620, 400 years ago, and we're striving for religious freedom.
Mine went to Jamestown.
To Jamestown. So I come from that 400 years of the American experiment. And I think that we have to be honest about our history, as we have been starting to be this year more than ever, about who it is that we have claimed as heroes from our past. Mm-hmm. And I think young people, myself and younger, are not going to put up with it. It's sort of, I hope what we're seeing is the last gasp of white supremacy, as those of us that are watching it in horror are saying, okay, no longer should we be so focused on the needs of people outside in this kind of white savior complex. It's time to really come home and focus on the problematics within how we haven't participated, our apathy and our lack of active participation in the world we want to live in. We have to create the world we want to live in, each of us, and every person has a role in that.
Yes.
So I
100% agree. But on the other hand, how do we deal with those whites that are still there behaving like that?
Yeah.
In other words, a lot of people right now are despaired because 73 million voted for Benedict Arnold.
Right.
And 73 million voted not to be the America that is the true dream, which is a multiracial dream, because they don't want to admit that the whites who came here actually were the riffraff and the draft and the dregs of the European caste system. Yeah. And they were escaping actually from an oppressiveness that they found in Europe. And then they started oppressing the Native Americans first, which of course even the Black Lives Matter people forget that they're not the worst example, actually. Even worse than them,
genocide.
Because at least they were worth money. But the worse than them are the Native people.
Yeah.
And I had an experience at Columbia, for example, where I tried to hire a Native American theologian who works in Athens at the University of Georgia, well, trained and here and there, you know, but he's a very, he coined an expression, the not quite post-colonial world, not yet post-colonial,
not yet.
Living on Cherokee land. And working for a white university after Jackson had, you know, killed so many of his ancestors who tried to assimilate with us and tried to be partners, neighbors to us, and then they were completely genocided anyway. Right. And he couldn't be hired in the new sort of post-colonial, you know, ethnic department that was formed by Black activists mainly, but some other people supporting. Because they wanted to first get the Blacks and Latinos. So they felt that was more important, and never mind the Native Americans. So they wouldn't hire this guy. And so there's that deeper trauma. We also have to embrace, you know.
We do. We have to acknowledge it, and we have to teach our children a different history than was taught to us.
Yes,
and we have to teach them that
the white people, that the white people actually are the ones who found refuge here, given by those people, and who still need refuge and who should not be behaving like imperialists. And we need that to show that as the real effort of America, so that we don't have to feel that we have to exterminate 73 million lunatics. Because there aren't that many, actually, really. They just get drawn into the dark side by the stupidity of the people. And I think there's really only 20 of them. You know, like
I also think, you know, there's like
18%.
So we had like more people voted in this last election than ever before, 140 mm-hmm. some, 150 some million. Mm-hmm. But there's 100 million eligible voters that didn't vote, 75 million or so. And so they represent who we need to work with more than the 73 who voted for Trump and get them
but
engaged.
But even the 73, this is the great thing about it. Even the 73 are not really there. Maybe of those 25.
Exactly.
The
I
real
think a lot
baddies,
of people don't know.
The real ones who need serious, you know.
Rehabilitation.
rehabilitation, yes, are only around 20. Yeah. I remember former Senator Bill Bradley telling me a couple of elections ago at a dinner that he always faced 18 to 20% loonies. You know, who were ready to shoot everybody and whatever.
Right.
And that was his steady. He was encouraging some other people at that dinner who felt really at sea and lost, you know, because of the, for example, you know, those people have basically burned Hillary like at the stake. She's been a witch burned, but not
Definitely.
For just not since 2016. She's been witch burned since 1986
since the beginning.
Or 1978.
She's the scapegoat of all misogyny.
Oh, she
is Hillary.
But actually, this is the key. She actually won. She won the election in 2016. We have to remember that.
Yeah.
The voter suppression, canceling the voter suppression, canceling the few extremists in power who blocked her and who added to the Roger Stone witch burning routine, you know, that did her in.
Yeah.
She actually still won the election.
Yeah.
So we still successfully elected her. And also we did elect Al Gore to turn against the oil dinosaur evil group, you know.
Yeah.
And but they suppressed and they cheated and they even got the court to cheat with them. And it was just a few people on the court. That's like three or four people who stopped the county in Florida. He won actually.
Yeah.
So we never, this is important for us. By the way, I don't refer to white people.
Okay.
I don't think there is a category. They're all pink.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely a construct.
No, they're pink.
I think
it's a category of pink. And even you could say blotchy pink
blotchy
in search
pink
of a
people.
Tan. Blotchy pink heading for the tropics in search of a tan. That's really their color. There's no white. White are some clowns painted with white chalk. There's no white. Right.
Pink. But there is a construct
people.
In people's minds of white supremacy that is so dangerous. Yeah.
A bunch of
it's
pinkos.
Dangerous
They're
and it's fake news. Yeah.
Do you dig that? They're pink.
Yeah.
I came up with that once giving a lecture at George Washington University in D.C., which is pretty much a black university. And I suddenly realized, listen, guys, don't be pissed. I'm not white. I'm pink. Everybody's only just and blotchy pink, especially when you get alcoholic, like they mostly are.
Exactly.
You know, their drug of choice is alcohol, and then then the nose gets all veins come out, the little capillaries, and they're really blotchy pink.
Yes.
And so that's key. That's what we're worrying about: blotchy pinks who are putting on powder like clowns to be white. We have to realize that, and we have to keep humor in there and don't feel desperate. You know,
right.
That's really really key.
You know, I'll tell you, this year I had a really sobering experience in which I had been invited into a book club in a large
mm-hmm.
corporation that was doing a
mm-hmm.
new book club to look at issues of racial equity and social justice.
Mm-hmm.
So I was brought in as sort of a white American activist who talks about some
mm-hmm.
of these issues through my path to becoming a global activist. And the week before, or about a month before I was on the docket, Trump issued this executive order against racial and sexual stereotyping for
mm-hmm.
all private and public contractors of the government. You could no longer talk about racial diversity trainings. You could no longer talk about sexism.
Really?
You could no longer talk about white supremacy or white privilege. And so I got a call from the corporation I was going to be working with that their lawyers had deemed my book kind of too controversial. And they've put me back on the docket for after the inauguration. But
see,
in all seriousness, that executive order affected universities. I know Berkeley issued a list of topics you couldn't talk about in class. I mean, this is extremist stuff. So as much as whiteness is not real, it is real in terms of this kind
of
protection
of course,
around even discussing it. And that was the specific wording I was told I couldn't use was white privilege as a term.
I was invited once when I used to do wide-scale lecturing to a Pepsi-Cola thing. And there they had two lunches with me ahead of time to insist that the only way I could come would be if I didn't mention Tibet. I couldn't come if I had to mention Tibet. So I just said, okay, I'll do it. I don't have to talk about Tibet. I can talk about general ethics and this and that and so on. And then it was so funny. Richard Holbrooke was at the same convention, same event. Yeah. And the first thing he did, because he hadn't been prepped, when he gave his talk, of course, ahead of me, because it's more important, you know, the late Richard Holbrooke. And he said, oh, you guys should ask Bob about Tibet. And they all went, oh, they were doing semaphore signals and all this kind of nonsense. So anyway, to get revenge on them, I told a joke about a Coke joke in a Tibet, in a Pepsi thing, and nearly got burned at the stake
nearly
myself.
Got burned. Well,
nobody laughed at an excellent joke because it involved Coca-Cola. So you can't do that. You can't even mention the word. It's like a religion.
No.
So people can become fanatical about whatever it is the point. We have to be careful about that.
Definitely.
Anyway,
we've been trying
you are such a breath of fresh air. You are such
thanks,
a YOLO at.
YOLO at. One at a time.
I love it. And so, but one thing you didn't tell me, what's the latest thing you're writing? The last thing. Last question.
Yeah, I'm working on two things. Mm-hmm. One, I'm working on a documentary about the protest at Mount Everest.
Good.
And
we
shot incredible behind the scenes footage on the way across Tibet and all the way up to the morning of the protest.
Oh, great.
Now,
wonderful.
You won't be shocked to hear that we've received some backlash in Hollywood about that same thing. You mentioned Tibet, and people get very scared. A backlash around making films.
So, Chinese investment is all over Hollywood.
Hollywood. And so we've been trying to find some brave filmmakers to partner with us to make that happen and risk their names. But and I'm writing a book about motherhood, about mothering on the edge and about raising young warriors, young anti-racist global citizens to kind of reform this world we've done so much destruction to. So that's what I'm working on now. Yeah.
Good for you. You know, just before this, just the other day, in thinking about our interview today, and I hope it's the first of many because I needed to learn a lot from you. Boy, I think you're really an avant-garde. You really are. The young people are. And the thing is that I was reading a wonderful interview Jonathan Cott, a friend of mine, did years ago, published in a book of interviews, with the author of P.P. Longstocking.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, was that a current book in your Shambhala youth? Did you all read
P.P. Longstocking?
I loved
that book.
Oh, good.
She was one of my big influences.
That is really good.
Yeah.
I think, you know, maybe we need to find that we need the Tibetan P.P. Longstockings. We need some young Tibetan P.P. Longstockings and Tibetophile Longstockings. It's amazing. Astrid Lindgren is the name of the lady, and she gave an amazing interview she gave. I don't have it electronically or as a PDF, or I'd send it to you. You would really be inspired by it.
I'll look for it.
So I can see you. I can see you doing that in this current. What would P.P. do during the Trump administration, during the final days of the colonial, not yet post-colonial planet, which has to be post-colonial, actually. And we have to do it in a decade. We don't have 50 years.
We don't.
Those people, those politicians who say, we'll be cool. But like the lie of Xi Jinping, who I used to kind of hope for, but I've now a bit given up for the moment. I never give up permanently anybody, but I have now a bit given up the Politburo, really, in China. They're just really forget about it. But the point is, I forgot what to say.
P.P. Longstocking. I can say that I think what I loved about P.P. Longstocking.
When they say 60 years, they're going to be carbon neutral. Forget about it. That's not possible.
Forget about it.
In 10 years, we need 10 to 15, maximum 2035. If we're not settled in 2035, forget about it. It's just over.
I think California. That we all need to find out where our resiliency is, where our to push, to kind of put ourselves forward out of our comfort zones and be resilient for this fight, for our climate, for our future, for our freedom. And I think there's no more resilient example than Tibet. And so I honestly think if you look at the longest standing nonviolent sort of cry for independence, that we can look at that and say, like, that's where I draw my resiliency from. And I try to channel it into other people who are becoming activated because that's the kind of commitment we're all going to need. We're going to need that level of commitment.
Right. Our thing is where we're going to, in your lifetime, I'm not sure mine, but in your lifetime, we're going to paint that friggin' White House rainbow colored, like the bridge in San Francisco, the tunnel after the Golden Gate Bridge. You know, no, we're going to paint those pillars rainbow striped.
It's
going to be glowing, you know, like mandala entrance, you know, not this white pathetic thing for some pink people to live in. Forget about that. Forget about
that. That was built by slaves. Yeah, I agree.
All right.
Well, thank you, Bob.
Big hug.
It was so good to
talk
to you.
Let me.
I will.
Say hi to Phil.
I'll say hi to Philly.
YOLO at.
YOLO at.
I want to do a tattoo like that for the young people. Okay.
I hope we can come by in our VW van at some point.
Okay, this guy, my engineer, Justin. I'm thanking my engineer, Justin here. He was a member of Occupy. He was a charter member of Occupy down here in New York. But somehow he's landed up here, you know.
And, excellent.
He's over the hill. He's too old like me. But not as old as me. But he's on the campaign.
I've been letting a little bit of my gray hairs show in the pandemic.
You see, you're beautiful. Don't worry.
Well, thanks, Justin.
Well, thank you so much, Kiri. It was really fun talking to you. And I want everyone to know that they can find your book in all different kinds of ways. And I really would like people to have access to it. And the link is coming on. And I hope to talk to you again soon. All the best. Bye.
The Bob Thurman Podcast is produced under a Creative Commons No Derivatives Share License and is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US Menla membership community and listeners like you. Please feel free to share, post, and like on your favorite social media platform. Tashi Dalek, and thanks for tuning in.